recorder appears to be on and functioning. Very good. Number of things before we start on the Chinese law. First, you really ought to have paper topics by now or in the very near future. I hope that those of you who haven't thought of neat ideas for papers are busily trying to do so. Places you might look if you don't have ideas, sort of the first place I would suggest looking is into yourself and say, what special knowledge, interests, expertise do I have? Do I know some exotic language? Do I have relatives who came from some strange and alien place? And no, I don't mean Southern California. And do I have a avocational interest in some particular period of history? Is there something about me that suggests a particular odd legal system I might look at? If you give up on that, one next possible source to look at is the anthropological literature. I mentioned the book by Hubble, which we had readings in previous years. We don't this year, but it has a bunch of chapters on different societies, and you can see what you can get from that for ideas for things you might want to read.
Yep. In terms of the reverse, would you strongly recommend not writing on something that you're not that familiar
with? No, nothing wrong with improving your education. No, I mean, you can make yourself familiar with something. I just think a good starting point is to see if you've got some natural target. And I think I've mentioned a student who was a Mormon who wrote about the legal system of the Mormon Church, a student who was fluent in Vietnamese who wrote about ancient Vietnamese law, and I'm sure there were some others. I assume that the student who wrote about prison gangs in California prisons was doing it on the basis of secondhand information, although I did not actually query the author of that paper on that subject. Anthropology is another good possibility. You know, if you are sort of brave and aggressive, you could wander into the anthropology department here and sort of walk into people's offices and say, hey, I'm taking this weird seminar in the law school on legal systems very different from ours. Do you happen to know about some human society in the anthropological literature that's got a weird and interesting legal system with enough documentation to write a paper on? That would be, you know, for people who like bearding lions in their den, that would be a possible strategy. Anthropology is one possibility. History is another possibility. There have been an awful lot of human societies, most of which have not yet been covered in this course. So you could sort of poke around the web or an encyclopedia or a history book or something and say, well, you know, somewhere in Southeast Asia, there's someplace other than Vietnam, which is the only one I've had an article on yet so far. I'm not counting China because we study it. Maybe I can find a whole lot about, who knows, you know, Burma or Thailand or some other such society. And in each case, sort of the first step is to find a candidate, and the next is to make sure there's enough information available to actually write a paper about that candidate in a language you read, which is obviously a constraint for most of us. A third possibility, which is partly historical and partly not, is looking at non-state legal systems. For example, the Mormons that I mentioned. Historically, there's been work done on the law merchant, law, basically in the Middle Ages, where you had private law evolving out of the trade fairs, and which I think is where a good deal of our Uniform Commercial Code ultimately originates, if you track it back. There's been work by Lisa Bernstein, who I think is now a professor at law school in Chicago, on private arbitration in modern societies. She sort of is the person who, I guess, was the leading scholar in that field. You could look up her stuff and see if you find something that looks interesting. You can look at religious or ethnic communities. The Amish have been done, but there must be some others like that that would fit. You might look at the Internet. I'm not sure if there's a good paper to be written there, but you could think about people are interacting online. To what extent are there either enforceable rules, or if there aren't enforceable rules, are there norms of behavior that are enforced in some way by how people act on various parts of the Internet? That would be a possible topic that's sort of for the high-tech types. And you can also look at illegal organizations. That there's quite a good book, at least one good book I know of, on the Sicilian Mafia by someone who's actually trying to understand what it is and how it works rather than just make movies or something. And there might be similar things for some other criminal organizations where, you know, if you're in a criminal organization, you've got the same problem. You want to make sure that you, the wrong guys don't get murdered, including you. You're going to have disputes over, you know, contracts as to dividing up the loot. You can imagine all sorts of essentially legal issues in a context where it isn't practical to appeal to the state courts to settle your disputes, and you therefore have some set of rules and some way of settling them. That's probably true for any reasonably well-organized criminal enterprise. People talk about organized crime sort of casually in a way that suggests that it's something sort of like General Motors, a big hierarchical corporation. I'm pretty sure that's not true. It's clearly not true of the Sicilian Mafia, because I've read Gambetta's book on it. And I don't think it's true of anything in the U.S. I think what organized crime really is more like a Better Business Bureau. That is to say, a bunch of people engaged in criminal enterprises who know each other have ways of settling their disputes, of hiring each other, dealing with each other, and so forth. So it really is a marketplace rather than a hierarchy. But within that, there surely are, you know, organized ways in which people do things, and that could be a good deal of fun to look into. There's the usual problem that, for some reason, people in criminal enterprises are less friendly to scholarly investigation of what they're doing than people in other projects, but nonetheless, stuff does get published. There's a book called The Last Testament of Lucky Luciano, which at least purports to be a report of extensive interviews of a major Prohibition-era criminal firm. Or maybe just Prohibition-era criminal figure. It's quite interesting, and, you know, that's what I came across, but I'm sure there are others. So all of those are possibilities. For an even farther out possibility for the enterprising people, you might find it fun to try to reconstruct a fictional legal system. If you have a series of books by a thoughtful and able author describing some foreign or future or fantasy or whatever world, if it actually has implicit in it a legal system, you could try to extract that. The only person I know who's made that effort so far is my daughter, who audited this course 3 or 4 years ago when she was, I think, 14 or 15, homeschooled student who likes sitting in on my classes, only now she's a college student, so she doesn't get to. And she did a paper, which was not entirely satisfactory. It was an interesting effort based on a... Quite a few papers are entirely satisfactory, including mine, based on a very good series of science fiction books by a woman by the name of Bujold, the Bariar series, for those who've read it. And she tried, I was trying, that was a really neat project, to go through the books and figure out where they mention things that involve the legal system. What is the implied set of political and legal institutions in the world that those books are describing? I thought it was a neat idea. And that's probably makes less sense than the others as a target, but it is a possibility. It could be fun, especially if there's some body of work that you know very well. Yeah.
Do you think like Star Wars and the Jedi?
I don't know. That is, in the case of Star Wars, I gather there's an elaborate written literature as well as the movies, and I simply do not know if people who did that were sufficiently careful about internal consistency to have such a thing. But yeah, I mean, it's not as if the main purpose of this paper is to enlighten the scholarly world. It's much more for your own education in figuring out how does one make sense out of a legal system other than ours. And from that standpoint, if you've got enough data, I wouldn't suggest plunging into reading, watching the Star Wars movies and reading the books only for this purpose. But if you're already a fan and you know the stuff well, then, as my daughter was of the books that she was using, then that might be an interesting project. Yeah. Yes?
What about a legal system that's not fictional? Does that imply a Baha'i law?
Isn't Baha'i law applied among the Baha'i by themselves?
No, because it's supposed to be in advance of utopian society.
I see. Yeah, that. My guess is that would be less interesting, but that would really be up to you. But don't the Baha'i have rules for controlling their own people? Because you could look at that. You might do something on Baha'i law that included both what they now have and what they propose for the future. That might be fun. Other comments, questions. Anyway, you're all supposed to be doing it. Maybe next time I do it, I'll actually put in an explicit deadline for when you have to give me your topics as well as a deadline for drafts. But I haven't gotten quite that organized yet, or impressive, as you may prefer to look at it. Next thing I wanted to do, especially since we're on the subject of fiction and are talking about Chinese law, is to recommend some light reading that's actually relevant to the course. There is a series of books that were written by a Dutch sinologist, student of China, by the name of Van Gulik. And as he gives the account, I think, at some point when he was, a Dutch ambassador or consul somewhere either in China or Japan or somewhere in that part of the world, he was struck by the fact that the sort of educated young Chinese were reading Chinese translations of junky third-rate Western mysteries, and weren't aware of the fact that there was a whole literature of mysteries in Chinese literature. And he decided to do something about it. And he started out by producing a book, I think in both Chinese and in English, though I only know the English version, of course, which was basically a mystery novel based on materials from the traditional stuff, although I think he put together chunks from several, 14th century or something, were Chinese works. Centering on a detective, so to speak, by the name of Judge D, who is apparently was probably a real figure, but is also sort of a Sherlock Holmes figure in the Chinese literature. But of course, whereas Sherlock Holmes is the world's first practicing private detective, Judge D, since he's in Imperial China, is a bureaucrat. He is a district magistrate. He is the person who is combination mayor, chief of police, and judge for a small chunk of China, a particular district in China. And Van Gulik went on to write a series of books, which are, I think, some of them are really short stories and some of them are novels, which are all set in traditional China, all have D as the detective, and among other things, give you a sort of a vivid portrait of that society and its legal system. He's a real scholar. This book actually mentions a scholarly work of his. He apparently translated some law cases earlier than these ones. The Judge D books, if you look under Judge D and online, you can easily enough find the titles of the books, are actually quite readable stories. One interesting difference between the Chinese detective story and the Western detective story, which is at least true of his first one, and I don't remember how consistently he stuck to it, is that a Chinese detective story is not a whodunit, because you see it from the standpoint of the criminal as well as the detective, and so the reader normally knows whodunit from the beginning. The story is rather about how the detective finds out whodunit. It's sort of the conflict between the clever criminal and the hopefully still more clever district magistrate or whoever it is who is detecting the case. So it's not the same as our form. It's older than our form, I think. That is, I think, at least I don't know, maybe there are classical detective stories from Roman Empire or something, but at least I think of the detective literature as starting in the 19th century, and the original Judge D books, not the Van Gulik ones, are much older than that. But anyway, it's sort of an interesting way of looking at it. Another point that you may or may not be aware of is that there is at least one major institution of modern Western societies which is a borrowing from the Chinese Empire. Do you know what that is? They invented the civil service. Copied, I think, by the British initially. But the idea of having a sort of a body of professional bureaucrats selected by objective tests and then sent hither and yon to do things starts in the Chinese Empire, 1500 or 2000 years ago, and is one of the central features of that society. So that, do you know how you become, how does Judge D become Judge D? How does one get to a position of, this is a centralized bureaucratic system, at least in theory, to some extent in practice. How does one get to a position of power in that system? Do you know? Yep.
Isn't it a series of taking tests?
That's correct. It's examinations that are all open to almost anybody. There are a few social classes which are seen as too debased essentially to be allowed to, but basically the random peasant, in principle, can go in for the exams. What are the exams in? Is this on how administration and law and stuff like that? Anybody know? It's on poetry and literature. It's, if you think of sort of the liberal education that theoretically all of us are supposed to have had, which is sort of an odd feature of our perception of how you were supposed to be educated, that if you want to end up as an engineer, you're supposed to have studied Shakespeare. Well, that also, I don't know, we may have gotten it independently, but that is, in fact, the Chinese attitude. If you're going to be a mayor, chief of police, judge for a district, how do you prove you're competent? Because you can write Chinese poetry in the traditional forms, because you can quote poetry, because you've read the classical works of philosophy and literature and so forth. So it's really quite a weird system, and yet it was a functional society for a very long period of time, and maybe there was something in it. But from the descriptions I've seen, at least, if you were an extraordinarily bright boy in the village, other sort of the villagers would band together and say, look, think of all the good things we could get if one of us was in one of these high positions. And so they would chip in to make sure that you had time, and presumably they'd have to pay somebody who already knew this stuff to teach you, and you would then study these things. And if you were really able enough, you might do well enough in the examinations to get at least a low-level civil service position. So it was really an interesting system. That's what the Mandarins were, basically, the people who had done this. What would you guess would be the obvious potential weaknesses, other than the fact that people are completely untrained for the job they're supposed to be doing? How might that system go bad? What would you be worried about if you were administering such a system? It's a perfectly obvious thing which everybody in the context of an American university ought to be thinking about. Yep. Cheating, that's right. And in particular, it's going to be very hard to cheat by smuggling in all of the Analects of Confucian written on your sleeve. So what would be the sensible way if you are, suppose you're reasonably well off but not too good on your literature, yeah?
I think the way they write it on the scroll, I never know if it's either closed.
That I don't know about. What I do know was they had elaborate procedures to make sure that the graders were not, in effect, being bribed or biased in some way, because that sort of is the obvious target. And it's long enough ago, so I don't remember, but I think some of it involved a copy of the thing in a different ink, color ink, and grading that, so you couldn't recognize the handwriting. And there was some period, I think, at which at least it was claimed that there was a whole lot of corruption, not so much in the form of bribery, but in the form of people who were officials making sure that their kids passed the test or their friends' kids passed the test. And there was then a shift to, I think, a fairly elaborate system of blind grading, which supposedly eliminated that problem. Now, it's been argued, I should say, whether correctly, I have no idea, that one result of this was to raise the average IQ of East Asians, because this is a polygynous society. So if you are an official, you are, by the standards of that society, rich and high status, which means you can have multiple wives, which means you can produce lots of children, so you're therefore selectively breeding for the ability to pass these particular exams. And, you know, whether you believe that story probably depends on how much you think those characteristics are heritable and how much they depend on environment and such, but it's at least one of the interesting theories about reasons for differences in different populations. Let me go back for a moment. I was noticing I had some notes on things with regard to writing papers that I should have covered and didn't, and that is the general issue of, if you've identified a possible subject, how do you get information on it? And one thing which I think people are not very likely to do and ought to, given the available current technology, is to Google for the names of current scholars in the field. So if you want to study the legal system of Armenia, somewhere in America there is a professor who is the expert on Armenian history. I have not checked this, but this is a prediction. If you want the expert on Icelandic history, I can point you at him, but I don't know anything about Armenian history. Iceland, anyway, saga period Iceland, at least. So one of the things to do is to locate that person or persons. First thing you do once you've located him is look at his webpage, which he probably has. The webpage probably has a list of publications. the list of publications. You can then go to our library with luck and find his classic book that nobody's ever read on the subject he's an expert in. Another thing you might be able to do using the web is find the syllabus of a course that he or somebody teaches on whatever bizarre subject you found and see what books are in it. A further thing you might do, assuming you're, again, reasonably brave and willing to interact with people, is to email him. You send an email and you say, you know, I'm thinking of doing a paper in my Santa Clara University Law School seminar about the following subject. I understand that you're knowledgeable. Can you suggest some readings? And sort of one of the odd things, maybe about the world, about the internet in particular, is that the person who seems high status to you in a particular context, you want to know about something and he's the expert in that, is probably not a high status person to the people around him. And therefore is quite likely to be flattered by having somebody say to him, I understand you're the expert in such a subject, can you point me at the relevant things? In addition to which, if he thinks that ancient Armenian history is the most fascinating subject in the world, and oddly enough none of his colleagues agree, he is likely to again be pleased by finding a fellow interested person who's asking a question. So I think you might want to think about both the sort of mechanical and the personal roads to gathering information. And once you've found your references, you can start by trying our library. I don't know if I've told you, but I concluded years ago that the Jesuits who run this university are dabbling in forbidden arts, some form of black magic, due to the fact that our library is better than it ought to be. That I have repeatedly gone looking for some very obscure thing which obviously couldn't be found in a library this size and found it. Real world example is a collection of Anglo-Saxon herbals, which I will not go into the reasons that I had to look for it, but I didn't expect to find it, and I did. And there have been other such examples. So start with our library, which is a good library. If you can't find it, consult with the librarians, and they may be able to tell you how to get it by interlibrary loan. Lexis and Westlaw have lots of odd stuff on them, in particular articles, so you might be able to find it there and so forth. So, in a sense, aside from viewing this paper as an opportunity to learn about some odd and interesting legal system, it's also an opportunity to practice research, which is a set of skills that you will find useful in your later professional. All right. Comments, questions on that stuff? All right, so now let me go on. If I have to, I can sort of go through a summary of the stuff that you've mostly already read in the readings, but I'd rather at least start by trying to get your responses to what you've just read. That you've read a fairly detailed description of a legal system that was ruling over hundreds of millions of people, that was ruling over substantial numbers for 1,000 to 2,000 years, depending on how much you think of it as changing over that period of time, looks rather unlike our own. What were your actions? What were the things that struck you as interesting or odd about that system? Anybody? Yeah?
I just think it was interesting how there was sort of the hydro of the plot of the legal and the sort of Confucian aspects of culture, how that kind of played out with the statues. You have these real rigid statues. Which was sort of a bond influence, and then sort of freshman by analogy, the two statues, which is sort of Confucianism. It was just interesting to see how that all played together.
If you think about, suppose we go back before the fusion, as it were, and you think about the legalists and the Confucianists as two attitudes to the law, although you're perfectly right, at least according to this book, which I assume is right, what you ended up with had elements for both. Who are the good guys? Or who are the progressives in our term, and who are the stick-in-the-muds? Is it the legalists or the Confucianists that we ought to say, well, they should have won because they were the ones with the right attitude to things? Yep.
It seemed like the legalists were very much more egalitarian, I guess, because they wanted to qualify equally to everybody.
So one striking difference between the two is that the legalists accepted the modern doctrine of everybody's equal under the law, and the Confucianists thought that was just a dreadful idea.
Just for fun, assuming I've got one of these things, let me make a list, because I find it, part of what I find intriguing about this is that our categories don't work very well for a different society. So, legalists and Confucianists
Legalists are legal egalitarians. I put it that way because I don't think
there's any suggestion that they thought that income should be equal, say. At least I don't have any, this time I'm not seeing any reference to welfare systems and that sort, but they thought the same law should.
Confucianist or something more like hierarchical law. But even that's really too... Huh? Hierarchical is wrong. What sorts of things did the Confucianists think the legal rule depended on?
Yep.
Sort of more cultural. I mean, you looked a lot to families and individual situations.
Could you, for instance, give me two different things to which the role rule would have been different, even though we would think it would be the same? Yes.
If a son hit his father.
Versus the father hit his son.
Yeah.
So law depends on, among other things, relationship of the parties.
Now, you might argue that there are a few narrow cases where that's true of our system. For example, there's one state in the U.S. where I can't disinherit my son, where the legal rules are such that various members of the family are entitled to a certain share of a decedent's estate, whether he wants them to have it or not, whereas in the other states, I think, are all freedom of testament. Anybody know what the one odd state is in the U.S.?
Yeah.
Very good. Why?
Because the French civil law.
Correct. You are entirely correct. Yes, I was thinking of Louisiana. So, and I guess, you know, wife can't be required to testify against her husband, things like that. But roughly speaking, our view of it is, except for minors, the insane, and non-citizens, all of whom somewhat different rules apply, but those aren't quite relationships. The law is supposed to be the same for everybody. Which gets to, what does it depend on other than the relationship of the parties? What else is relevant? Yeah?
Age.
Age. Well, we have a little bit of that. What else?
Gender.
A little bit of that, but not very much.
Yeah?
What's the big one you're leaving out?
Status.
Yeah, I think socioeconomic is probably too narrow. But status, that the rule is not supposed to be the same for the peasant as it is for the Mandarin.
Would it be wrong to think of the division between liberalism and Confucianism as kind of similar to artificial law and equity?
I don't know. I thought that Divinity Law and Equity had sort of vanished from law school teaching 50 or 100 years ago, but let me think. I'm trying to think about that. That's because which is which, by in your view? Explain. People are I don't know. I'm a law school student. I don't know what you're taught. People are aware that in the history of the British common law, you had at one point two quite sharply defined branches with different courts and such. One of them was courts of law, one courts of equity. Now continue. So that in some sense, law in the common law system was closer to a, here are the written rules, what do they imply, and equity was closer to what would be a fair outcome. Is that I'm not enough of a scholar of English common law to know how much that's a parity, but I think that's at least got some element of difference. What is true, which is related to that, is that there's the argument early on between the legalists and the pre-Confucianists, or maybe the Confucianists, about whether you should have written law. All right, what's the argument against having a written law? People will game it. That's right. So that if you have a written law, then these clever people will figure out wicked things to do, carefully designed not to violate the terms of the law. All right, and you know, in the Icelandic, if you read the Icelandic sagas, you could certainly see the, or if you read modern law, you can certainly see the issue of find the loophole with the law and exploit it, kind of thing. And the what's the alternative? Well, one alternative is have a just ruler who will punish you if you do bad things, and you want to know what bad things are if you've been properly educated in a moral and virtuous society. So that's certainly one of the controversies, and I think you might plausibly argue. But then I would, but then on that category, that sounds a little bit more as though the Confucianists are over on the equity side,
right?
And the so it's an interesting way of thinking about it, at least. Not sure if it works or not. Think about that as a category. Other thoughts? Yeah.
Now the distinction still holds in our system to some degree, but it's more based on what the remedy is you're looking for. So law means you're looking for money remedies, whereas the equity you're looking for declaratory relief or injunction or something like that.
Yeah. But in terms of this system, I don't see either that to begin with, you don't really have civil law in our sense at all. You've got civil law in the sense that the law deals with things like marriage and property ownership, but not in the sense of the law is resolving my claim against you, that all of the claims are really, in a sense, the state's claims about how we ought to behave, not that you owe me something and the state will act to enforce my right, at least judging by this. Again, none of us have lived in this society, and I'm always a little suspicious of sort of the official account that I remember some time back I was reading a history of the early Abbasid Caliphate, which would be around 800 AD, roughly Middle East, ruling a good deal of the Islamic world. And it looked to me as though if you really looked at what was happening, it looked a lot more like a feudal system than if you looked at it on paper. So that the two incidents that I remember there, and then we may come back to this when we're actually talking about Sharia, one of them involved the two sons of Harun al-Rashid, who both wanted to succeed him. And al-Rashid appoints the elder son to be the next caliph, the younger son to be the governor of the eastern provinces. And on the face of it, as described by the modern history, the elder son had all the cards in his hand, as it were. The eastern provinces had been in rebellion. He was officially the top guy, and his brother under him. And eventually, so al-Rashid swears everybody in sight to keep the peace between the two brothers, obviously seeing that would be a problem, and dies. And eventually there's a civil war. And the caliph raises an army and goes off to attack his brother. And the comment of the modern historian was that on the face of it, the caliph, Al-Amin, had all of the advantages, and Al-Mamun, his younger brother, the distant. The only problem was that Al-Amin's army had no competent generals except the one who was in charge of it, and the reason was that none of the other competent generals were willing to go. That doesn't sound like a hierarchical, centralized system where people get to decide whether or not they go. And then there was another chunk of the same book, I don't think it was the same time, but some point during the caliphate, where some local leader has been put under house arrest because of probably backing the wrong side in the civil war or something like that. And years pass, and the Byzantines invade, and the official forces are unable to stop them, and so the guy is let out of house arrest, and troops flock to his banner, and he defeats the Byzantines and drives them out. That sounds like a feudal system, in that it sounds as though the local leader has access to military forces that the central government doesn't have access to, which to me is sort of one of the striking features of feudal systems, that the military is under sufficiently decentralized control so that the king is more nearly a coalition leader than he is a sort of sovereign of his own power. But anyway, so it's worth at least thinking about those things. But at least as we have it described, it seems pretty clear that it's a society that doesn't think in terms of individual rights with regard to each other, but only of proper behavior and enforcing proper behavior. Other comments? Yeah.
I thought it was interesting just how the permeation of, or how it permeates kind of something like about what's called the Yiddish Chinese crimes of like younger family members against older family members.
Yes.
And think that's interesting because I think that's still part of like Chinese culture in general, at least from what I understand from my parents. You know, the Chinese kids bring, I guess, elders to the family. And
yeah, you know how far it goes. It doesn't seem surprising to me that children would be seen as somehow subservient to their parents, because after all, children spend the first chunk of their lives being effectively ruled by their parents. What seems a little odd is that the younger brother is subservient to the older brother, and what seems really odd is that if two cousins who've had no interaction, the one who is a year younger is permanently in an inferior status regard to the one who's a year older. On the other hand, between cousins of different generations, if you think about the relationship between you and your mother's sister's grandchild, who's a cousin once removed, even if, because of the ages of marriage and such, your cousin, your mother's sister's grandchild is older than you are, you are still the senior member. Do you have any feeling as to whether that still exists in the culture?
I don't know about that specific, but I think that the idea of, for example, I think even today, like Chinese parents never read their kids as being adults, because those are our lives, no matter how old you're doing, 65.
Right. But this is true of all cultures. It's not limited to the Chinese.
I still think that they tell you what to do and you should listen. And like in my husband's family, he's the oldest brother and he has a younger brother. And even though the younger brother, you know, is an adult, in their mentality, because he's the oldest son, he is responsible for the family.
That's interesting, yes. And the assumption is that his younger brother has more of an obligation to listen to him than he has to listen to his own. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. It will be interesting to see what my two children are like in that respect, say, in another 10 years. They're currently 19 and 16. Given that my son views sort of annoying younger brother as the role life has cast him in and that he intends to play it to the hilt, and that his sister, on the whole, seems to enjoy that, they may keep it up for another decade or so. We will see. But it did seem to me that that was sort of an intriguing feature of the whole system, not one entirely alien. As I say, lots of societies had elements of it, but one that was carried a whole lot farther and was internalized in the legal system in a sense in which we tend, if anything, to suppress it a little bit in the legal system, that we wouldn't think of the 40-year-old brother as having any special rights vis-a-vis the 38-year-old brother. On the other hand, of course, if you go back a bit, if both of them were sons of a king, the 40-year-old brother would have a superior right, he would inherit. And, of course, under primogeniture, not just for a king, but for some land, for land that was entailed, and under English law, it would go to the elder son. So there's... But it still doesn't feel the same, because part of that is you want to keep the land together so that the family won't get weaker and weaker, and God choose somehow. The Mongol system was the youngest son, by the way. I understand that in the descendants of Genghis Khan, the theoretical rule, I mean, to some extent, as with the Ottomans, it was really succession by fratricide, but the theoretical rule, I think, was that the youngest adult son was the one who succeeded. Can somebody see one obvious argument in favor of that system? What's that going to give you? Yep. That's right. It's going to give you a long reign, which you could see could have some real advantages. Disadvantages, too, but it could have some real advantages. That's the only society I know of which I'm told, at least. I haven't studied and did that. But it's interesting. All right. Other things that struck you? Yeah?
The big thing that struck me was that one line in the book where it said, the son defends his father, and then the father defends the son. I guess it was in a way, I can't remember who it was referring to, but it was something about...
It was Confucius.
Yeah, and it was not maybe telling on.
That's right. It was that somebody else had said, "Look what a good person this is." He even reported his father for a crime. I forget what it was. And Confucius says, "You know, among us, being a good person is different from that."
Yeah, it's kind of interesting.
That's
like,
right.
If you're going to this like, higher level, you know, you think that would breed like lying and stuff. You know.
Right. That is. Part of what's intriguing is that it's not just that Confucius isn't in favor of what the other guy is doing, he's against it. That they've got opposite views of what's honorable behavior. And I think you can think of a lot of examples. If you think about in our society, think about the Pentagon Papers, if any of you are familiar with this, but a case where you've got information which makes the U.S. look bad, but which is true, and the government's trying to conceal it. It could be Abu Ghraib or whatever it was, the prison in Iraq where people were being mistreated, depending on papers, was a Vietnam equivalent of that. And you could see one person saying, wasn't this a brave and patriotic person? He made this information public, even though he knew it was a great risk to his own, career. He might even go to jail and somebody else saying, what do you mean, brave and patriotic? He's a traitor. He made his country look bad. It's too bad it happened. We should keep these things from happening. But when they happen, you want to conceal them, not pull them on the front page of the New York Times. So that would be an interesting case of the same sort of where it would be fun to try to trace back the moral intuitions underlying each side. Now, my view, looking at it in terms of sort of the law rather than the morality, as I think I've discussed before, is that part of what's going on is this idea of subcontracting the control of people to non-governmental authorities. So that if you say, we want to make sure that people behave well, how do we do it? What, by the way, was the legalist system? What's the legalist way of preventing people from acting badly when you don't actually have enough cops to watch all of them? It's a very interesting solution, and one that's been used by other people since from time to time. I don't know if they were or not. I don't think that's mentioned in the book, at least. Yeah? Collective punishment, that's right. The system, I don't know if they really did it, but the proposed system is you have a group, you somehow grew people in a group of, say, 10 families. If anyone in your group of 10 families commits a crime and you didn't report it, we'll punish you instead. Or maybe punish him too. But we'll punish everybody in the group. Well, that's, that you hear stories of the Nazis doing that in Eastern Europe during World War II, that, a German soldier is shot by a sniper, kill everybody in the village. Next village will make sure that they suppress they make sure none of their people go around killing German soldiers. So it's, don't know, I mean, it's obviously got some risks, it makes you a lot of enemies as well as killing a lot of people, but if you don't have an easy way of finding out who really did it, it might be an effective method. Or even if you could find out who really did it, but you say to yourself, maybe he's a brave guy who's willing to kill a German soldier even if he gets killed, but is he willing to kill a German soldier even if it means that his parents, his siblings, and all his friends get killed too? Maybe not. But in any case, but the legalist, again, part of the weirdness is the legalist being at the one time seeming to have our values here, and yet seeming to be perfectly comfortable with what seemed like very unpleasant approaches to doing things in other respects. I should say the other thing that struck me reading it was that in terms of their attitude to human beings, the legalists look an awful lot more a lot like modern law and econ types. That we assume that the way you prevent people from doing bad things isn't to preach at them, it's to make it not in their interest to do bad things. Now, they are looking at only one of the ways you might make it not in their interest, namely punish them ferociously if you catch them doing it. But the general approach compared to the Confucians, who seem to be saying, no, the way you make people be virtuous, you teach them virtue. And that, in a certain sense, seems to be a tension that runs through thoughts about preventing crime in our society and in others for a very long time. is a prison a punishment, or is it a reform school? All right, reform school theoretically means a place where we teach people to be virtuous, where we reform them, we change them into better kinds of people, as opposed to the other attitude, which is, no, the reason we lock people up is people don't like being locked up. Therefore, if they know that robbing will get them locked up, they won't do it. And besides, even if we can't deter them, at least while they're in prison, they're only robbing other prisoners who we don't care about. So... So essentially, you've got these two different theories of dealing with crime and other bad behavior, quite explicitly in the very early Chinese case, and it seems to me, if you think about discussions of crime and punishment in modern societies, and for that matter, in the 19th and 18th century societies, the same issues are running through. So that struck me as sort of interesting as well. Other points that people found worth talking about? Yeah?
But I noticed that Chinese law is used the same law as the punishment divine sword.
Yep.
And I thought that was actually kind of neat because most most laws can trace back to, you know, some like Quran or Christianity or something, but Chinese law seems to be just very devoid of that, which I think is kind of.
Yeah, I'm just thinking because I'm not sure.
I don't think the Icelandic law makes any such claim either, as far as I can remember.
And I find it hard actually reading the Icelandic literature to figure out how much they really believed in their religion, to what that is, the pagan religion, the pre-Christian one, to what extent it was really something they believed in, or what extent it was sort of an interesting set of stories and, you know, stuff of that sort. I don't know. But yeah. I'm just thinking, English common law we think of as being created by judges over a period of time, and I'm not sure if you go back far enough they would say, yes, but we are following out divine commandments. I mean, the Jewish is pretty clear, and that was to some extent one of the bases on which later systems were built, I guess. They all knew the Old Testament, had references to it, and the Irish is pretty explicit about that. Yeah. Anyway, yes, but no, it is interesting. Again, you sort of, if you were trying to imagine Chinese culture from what little most of us know about it, you might well make the opposite assumption and say, well, you know, of course, I mean, they're, you know, primitive, unscientific folk. They doubtless thought that God handed down their law code. No, gods don't buy now. Law codes, the sages create the law code. Wise men figure out what the law ought to be. And that does strike me as interesting. At the same time, that what we would think of as religious ideas do greatly affect the content of the law. That, as you probably noticed, there are times you can't execute people. And part of course, is what you mean by religion. Right? That is... But if you think, suppose somebody says it is the nature of the world that certain months are months of death and decay and certain months are months of birth and renewal. Well, that seems like a reasonable description of, you know, fall versus spring kind of thing. And suppose you then say it is the nature of the world that the natural world and the human world are closely interlinked. And that therefore doing things that don't fit the right time of year in the human world can create catastrophes in the natural world. Is that religion? Or is it a scientific theory that might be wrong?
It sounds more scientific, or just not a humanist observation, but like a futurist observation. It just seems, it doesn't, when I think of religion, I think of most of having some belief either in a higher being or the being of a collective. So it's just like that observation just seems kind of.
Yeah. Well, I'm prone to argue that the driving force behind a lot of sort of environmentalism and related things is religious, but it's not religious in the sense of an appeal to a god, but more of a particular perception of the nature of the world, such as certain things seem wrong. If you ask somebody, why is it a bad thing if a species goes extinct? You might be able to fudge up some consequentialist reasons about, you know, maybe they'll be useful to us in the future, but the real reason is a gut-level feeling sort of, it's an ugly and bad thing to have a species go extinct. And that sort of seems religious in one sense and not another in the same sense this does. Yeah.
So are you saying that Chinese law was developed in this kind of thinking?
I'm saying that, at least according to the book, one of the features that affects it is that kind of thinking. That at least that's what they're claiming, that the business about what you can do in different seasons. And maybe further, the idea that a crime, aside from injuring people, to the extent that it's somehow contrary to the natural order, might have indirect effects. It's analogous, although less theist, than the idea that one reason to punish behavior forbidden by the religion is that otherwise God will punish us. If you think about the sort of standard way in which Sodom and Gomorrah get into American sort of political ideological thought. And I gather at least it argued, I think perhaps correctly, that the real sin of Sodom was not sodomy, but violation of the rules of hospitality. But that's not the way it's seen. And if somebody says the reason we should have laws against homosexuality is that God disapproves of it, and if we do very much of it, who knows, you know, God will punish us. Well, that is a religious argument, obviously, but it's an argument saying not we should do it because God wants us to, but we should do it because our doing what God doesn't want us to will result in bad material consequences. And it seems to me that that's analogous leaving out the God, to the Chinese saying, if you kill somebody, aside from hurting him, that's somehow a violation of the order of nature, and if we have very much of that, bad things will happen. Well, crops will fail. I don't know if they did that. That's an imaginary example. But the particular point, which I don't remember if it was discussed in these chapters or not, but which comes up at various points in the book, is that there seems to be a legal rule which says that if there has been a killing, somebody should die for it. But if the suppose the killing has been by three people, and suppose before you finish disposing of the case, one of them dies, you then don't have to execute the other two. You might choose to anyway, but that as I understand it, there is a belief that somehow there's a problem if a killing occurs and isn't sort of balanced by a killer, but by the death of someone responsible, and it's not as simple as we've got to deter crimes because the balance doesn't have to be punishment. Yeah.
I understand it, but it doesn't seem to be balancing if you kill someone from the natural causes. Like, to me, it
doesn't seem balancing to me either, but I get, if their account is right to them, it did, yeah?
Then if it's a nature-based argument, then it is.
It's a death for a death,
yeah. Yeah. I guess I'm being more like vindication or
That's right. But they're not thinking in terms of vengeance, or at least if I understand that they aren't. They're thinking more, in some terms, more like when we talk about the balance of nature. You can make really ecological arguments about the balance of nature, but a lot of it really is sort of this feeling of what somehow seems like the right balance, and I think that's going in. Yeah. I don't remember. I have to admit, I have not reread all of the assigned chunks. I read them in the past. I reread part of them today. I don't remember that being there, but it could be.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Yes. Don't know. But there clearly are a whole bunch of rules sort of that, again, feel sort of religious about ancestor worship. And one of the things that they mention here is you initially have a rule which says that somebody who would ordinarily be exiled far away, if he's the only support of his aged parents, we will punish him with something that doesn't move him away so he can take care of them. And at a later point, even if his aged parents are dead, he can still be their only support because somebody's got to do the appropriate rituals for this basic, I suppose, the souls of the ancestors, and he's the only one to do that. So that sort of is in that general genre, as it were, of ideas and things. But as I say, but there does seem to be something for which balance of nature might be the closest metaphor we've got, even though their idea of the balance of nature doesn't have to be the same as our idea of it. That's one of the things running through it. At the same time, I mean, my temptation as an economist is to look at each of these things and say, can I find a rational reason for it? And in the case of the familiar relationship stuff, the answer is yes. I'm not sure I'm right, but a plausible to me story is the imperial authorities want to reinforce, not undercut, the familial authorities, because the imperial authorities, rather than having this arbitrary 10-family nonsense under the legalists, the imperial authorities are saying, well, look, the extended family is a bunch of people interacting with each other. How about we say to them, not that we'll punish you for your children's sin, children's crimes, they pretty explicitly are not doing that, but rather we will help you control the rest of the people in your extended family, and thus we won't have to worry as much about them. And that, I think, is at least a possible explanation, which doesn't depend on philosophy and culture and all the rest of it. It's sort of purely consequentialist. And I'm sure that such explanations are not an adequate description of the world, but they're sometimes a better description than you might think, and they're sort of a one can, you know, what's somebody's line, if you have a can opener, everything looks like a can. I guess usually if you have a screwdriver, everything looks like a screw. If you're an economist, everything looks like rational behavior, because that's what we've got the tools to analyze and to think about. And it's at least part of what's really going on, the only part. One of the things that struck me as sort of not major but interesting was the distinction between nominal and actual punishments. And it's sharp enough so that if I remember correctly, I don't know where this is, but I think this is from a previous reading, there are situations in which the life for a life can be satisfied without actually killing somebody. that you can condemn somebody to death, and in some ways he doesn't die, and that somehow does it too, because he's officially been condemned. That doesn't always do it, but I think there are situations where it does. But I was also noticing all of this odd stuff about the number of blows of the bamboo, and that you've got a sentence which says, for this crime the punishment is 30 blows of the bamboo. Ah, but the Mongols decided that 10 is really 5. So actually, when we say 30 blows of the bamboo, we really mean 15 blows of the bamboo. And things of this happening, where you keep the written stuff the same, but you change the actual substance of it. And there are a number of other things which have a little bit of the feeling of this. For example, you could condemn an official to some punishment such as 30 blows of the bamboo, but because he's an official, he's allowed to pay a fine instead. So he's officially gotten the same punishment as somebody else, except he doesn't. Ditto for women to some extent. And furthermore, did people follow this whole elaborate business about after the assizes? About your sentence to decapitation after the assizes. Why do you care very much whether or not they wait till the fall assize to cut your head off? Anybody? One of the elements discussed at some length. Nothing to do with nature. At least, maybe it has to do with nature too, but at least as far as what they're describing, it's nothing to do with nature. Yep. No, it has to do with pardoning. Well, not really pardoning, with commutation. That what's going on is a very elaborate system in which you are condemned to a punishment, and then they think about it and maybe move it to a lower punishment. So execution before the assizes, which is for really serious capital crimes, they cut your head off. Execution after the assizes, they lock you up, and at a particular point there's an elaborate procedure which is quite likely to result in your decapitation being reduced to strangling. You might not care, but if you believe it's important that the body stay whole, you care. Or your strangling being reduced to 3 years penal servitude, which is quite a large change. And part of this is a procedure which people seem a little unsure of the details of, but it somehow involves having a sheet of paper or something on which the names of all the people condemned to be executed are written. And the emperor draws a circle on it. We're not quite sure whether the people inside or outside who get off, but only a subset of the names actually get executed, and the others go back to prison. And if the emperor's missed you 3 times, I think you're commuted to some number of years of penal servitude, if I remember correctly. But it is an elaborate procedure in which what's the pattern of it that I can see is that the actual punishment is on average substantially less than the official punishment. So you're condemned to die, but then we don't actually, maybe we execute you, but very likely we just scare you a few times and then give you a lesser punishment. And that reminded me of one of the things that people obviously don't know, which is the same pattern in English 18th century law. That the authors of this, naturally enough, are sort of defensive about their system, and they realize that people who aren't familiar with China will think of the death of the thousand cuts as torturing people to death. That's horrible, and weren't they bloody-minded people who did all these horrible things? But they say, no, if you look at it more carefully, compared to, let us say, 18th century England, where 5 shillings stealing from a shop got you hanged, they were pretty merciful. And you then look at 18th century England, and to begin with, as a normal rule, it was 40 shillings, not 5 shillings, which was the division between a non-clergyable felony, which was a capital offense, and something lesser than that. I don't know the rule for the shop, but I know that stealing from a house with people in it who you put in fear was a capital offense, even if less than 40 shillings. Well, that's not an unreasonable distinction. May have been something similar with a shop, but the more important point is that what they don't realize is that parallel to the system of assizes that they point out in the Chinese case, there was a system of pardons in the 18th century English case, with the result that somebody who had in fact stolen 5 shillings from a shop was a good deal less than even chance of getting hanged. He might get hanged. It was possible, as it's possible in this case. But he might get convicted of a lesser included offense because the jury didn't think he ought to be hanged. He might be convicted of the offense, sentenced to hang by the neck until dead, and then pardoned and sent home. he might more commonly be convicted of a non-clergyable felony, sentenced to hang by the neck until dead, and then asked him if he was willing to enlist in the Army or Navy in exchange for a pardon. Or if he was willing to agree to be transported to the Carolinas to serve as an indentured servant for 14 years in exchange for a pardon. Part of my point is just that the experts in each field tend to accept the common wisdom on everything else. But the other point is that there does seem to be a fairly common pattern here of having punishments that are more severe on paper than in reality. Yeah.
Do you think in each of the systems
are
for the same reasons?
I don't know.
Why you would have these two?
I don't know. But one possibility that suggests itself is that if you want to deter crime, deterrence doesn't require you ever punish anybody. It only requires people think you're going to punish them. So one of the points which is made, mentioned here with regard to the legalists, and which is in a sense a point that modern law and econ people think about too, is make the punishment severe enough, nobody ever commits the crime, you never have to punish them, so therefore severe punishments are good. Alright? Now, it's not that tidy for a variety of reasons that I don't think we have any cases with even very severe punishment where you get the crime level down to zero, but it is an argument we're thinking about that to some extent the more severe punishment means you impose it less often, which could be
we have that in our system with the maximums or minimum guidelines, but then when it comes to the bifurcated system you have the sentencing and then there's all these mitigating factors.
But it's also true of parole that somebody is sentenced to 10 years, but presumably what you really know is that means 5 years, and then unless he's misbehaved, you let him out of parole. So we have various versions of that as well. I think that's right. And now there could be a variety of motives, and one obvious motive in our case is that prisons are expensive. So therefore, if you can scare him with 10 years and only have to lock him up for 5 years, that's a net gain. Another one might be that prisons are expensive, but voters are in favor of harsh penalties, so if you can pretend to have a harsher penalty than you do, you can win at both ends. I mean, those are also, and I'm not sure which such motives are going on here. The suggestion here is that if they feel that depriving somebody of life is a very serious thing, so you should only do it when you absolutely have to. That might be what's going on. Might also be that they think that the population is good, that they want to have, that after all, if we send you off for penal servitude, you're going to make a bunch of iron or salt for the empire. We want the labor for doing that. Why should we waste workers by killing them? So I don't know what's going on. And at this point, what I'm really pointing out is not that I have a good theory, but only that it's an intriguing pattern that you notice in at least several, I don't know how many, but several different systems of having punishments which are nominally more severe than they are actually. There was another case which I was a little bit curious about, except that I haven't noticed any real explanation, theoretical explanation, and that's this business of where people get exiled to. That as the book discusses, if you're punished to exile at a distance of 2,000 li from your home, it doesn't just mean you can go anywhere that's 2,000 li for your home. It means that somebody opens up the book with the big complicated list, and the list says, this penalty, this guy committed his crime in this district and this province. According to the book, people who are exiled from this district and this province to a distance of 2,000 li are to go to that district and that province. And that at least sort of arouses my curiosity why you have that elaborate system. Can people suggest some possibilities as to why you don't just say, put him in a chain gang, when you get past 2,000 li, let him off at the nearest place that can use labor? Why would they have this elaborate system? Any guess? It's only a guess, and I don't know. I'm just speculating. Yep.
I would say then it would be more known who was actually exiled, because in that other town, the places with receiving people, it isn't, you lose your autonomy if you are sent to a specific place, you have this system in place, I would think.
Because it might be a bureaucratic system for keeping track of people. Although, on the other hand, the suggestion here seems to be that people sentenced to penal servitude in their own province were actually working, producing iron and salt, whereas people sentenced to exile, they at least don't think were kept very much track of, other than they didn't come home again.
So I guess I'm going to have to get into the people from that town, maybe knowing that that's what's happened, that that's who you are.
Maybe. And you could also see that if you're going to create a sort of a subpopulation in some district of foreigners, it would be nice if they could understand each other. If you only have two languages, given that China, of course, then and to some extent now, is not a linguistically homogeneous society, right? You had a whole bunch of what are called dialects, but which my understanding is that the spoken form of Cantonese and Mandarin are not mutually comprehensible. And I think that's even true within finer distinctions of that. So you might say, well, simplify things if the policemen in this district only have to understand two languages among potential offenders and witnesses and not 73. That would be a possible reason. Another possible reason, which again has to do with sort of corruption, is if you don't have fixed rules, it would be a lot easier for the person who's been sentenced to exile at 2,000 li to slip a bribe to somebody who's doing the allocating and get placed somewhere much closer or somewhere much pleasanter, maybe. That might be, you know, do you go north or south? And there is, in fact, exile to a malarial district. That was one of the punishments. Well, they're making distinctions on different places to be exiled to, you might make those distinctions too. So that sort of struck me as another interesting bit of the whole system, which I don't understand very well, but I just think it's sort of fun to try to tease out these different features and see to what extent you can make any very limited extent to which you can make any sense of them. Somebody was saying something? No. So some of the questions about going back to religion for a minute is the question of whether when religion shows up in the Chinese or other systems, legal systems, it's really the reason for the rule, it's used to reinforce a rule that exists for other purposes, or an explanation of a rule that exists for other purposes. And again, if we think for a moment about laws against sodomy, which, as you may know, were quite serious not that long ago. That sodomy, I think, in England 100 years ago was a capital offense. I'm pretty sure that's right. And I gather, and you know, it's sort of hard to know because this is the kind of issue where people have access to grind, but I gather that if you actually read the Bible, sodomy is not high up in the list of things you're not allowed to do. That it's clear that it is condemned a couple of times in the Old Testament. There's at least one passage in Paul in the New Testament. But then there are a lot of other things that are condemned. And it's not like adultery was considered a capital crime, or non-marital sex in general, all of which are condemned at various points in the Old or New Testament. So you might say what's really going on is that for whatever reason people feel this is a horrible, icky thing to do, and since they feel that way, they want to have laws against it, and since they have laws against it, they look to biblical justification for those laws. That's a possible story. Whether it's a correct story, I don't know. You might also think of some other possible explanations for the same pattern. Imagine the following case in our society. Suppose you could somehow have a case of somebody who had committed some really sort of ugly and inexcusable murders, but for whatever reason, punishing him will neither deter nor prevent those murders. Maybe he's committed the murders, but somehow the outcome is such that he's never possibly going to be in a position to do it again. He's ended up, crippled and can't possibly kill anybody again. It seems to me that there would still be a lot of pressure to punish him. And that, we wouldn't put it in religious terms, but that sort of suggests that our system of criminal punishment, which can be put, and which some of us, me included, would like to put, in terms of a rational system of deterring and perhaps incapacitating people so they won't hurt each other, has somewhere behind it an element of a religious-like feeling of these things are bad and it is wrong that they should go unpunished. Make sense to people? All right, anyway,
Can you talk about where the question necessarily has to come from?
religion. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying...
I thought the idea was that, it's, that there's like this moral absolute outside of the legal system that requires the punishment to happen. So you know, there's legal rules to support that because there's this sort of sentiment.
That's right, and I think that those sentiments, I mean, religion is perhaps too narrow a term, but there's somehow an element of, I want these things not as a means towards other commonly shared goals like being healthy and happy, and but I want these things for themselves, somehow.
And they are just natural goods.
That's right, somehow. And it seems to me that, I mean, I find it interesting to try to interrogate my own intuitions. I've actually set up in one of my books an efficient murder. That is a hypothetical case where I've rigged the story so that on standard law and econ grounds, I have no grounds to object to this murder. I still, my gut feeling is it probably ought not to be legal, and I'm sure that everybody else's gut feeling is it shouldn't be legal. No, this is actually based on a short story, only I've modified it for my purposes. The short story is called The Most Dangerous Game. And it involves a wealthy big game hunter who has hunted various animals and has finally concluded that the only game dangerous enough to be fun is man. And so he somehow gets a hold of someone, I don't remember the details of how, on his private island and hunts him. And of course the hunted guy ends up killing the hunter, which is vindicates the claim that it's the most dangerous game, right? So in my version is consensual. In my version, the wealthy hunter finds 10 adventurers. And he says to them, here's the deal I got for you. I will pay you $100,000, each of you $100,000, if you agree that I can randomly select one of the 10 and do my best to kill him. Suppose they agree to the deal. If you think about it in terms of sort of standard economic arguments of economic efficiency, they're agreeing to the deal means that each of them regards $100,000 as worth more than the cost of one chance in 10 of having somebody try to kill him. The hunter regards $1 million, the price he's willing to pay for the excitement of having a chance to try to kill one of these 10 people. So it's hard to make an economic argument against it. And you're tempted to fudge one up by saying, but other people might get killed in the process. Other people will be upset about this. Suppose he does it nice and quietly, again, private island. You still feel as though when 10 years later the facts come out, he ought to be punished somehow. And yet it's hard to make a good argument why. So that's I constructed that precisely to sort of push the tension between the consequentialist arguments, which are the ones we usually make, and the moral intuitionist arguments, which are somewhere in us. So I thought that was sort of interesting. Alright, it's not very important, but do people understand about the whole banner system, which sort of keeps showing up in bits and pieces of this? That basically, the previous dynasty was conquered by the Manchus with the aid of a bunch of Mongols and with the aid of some Han Chinese who, for whatever reason, went along with them, probably who didn't like the previous dynasty, and that ends up sort of fossilized as a system of 24 banners, where each banner is a military unit. But as far as I can tell, at least by the end of this period, they aren't much good as military units. That they're sort of theoretical military units. And 8 of the banners are Manchu, 8 are Mongol, and 8 are Chinese. Of course, in a certain sense, they're all Chinese because this is a couple of centuries after the conquest. But in terms of their ancestry, they are theirs. And because of their special role, there are special rules in the legal systems for what happens to somebody in a banner who does various things as opposed to what happens to an ordinary person. So that's an extra category which presumably didn't exist in previous dynasties, but existed as a result of the historical accident of the dynasties. There was another point here I have, which I thought was sort of interesting, which was some attempt to figure out just how severe or non-severe their legal system was. Because I was trying, something I often try to do in these cases, to see if you can actually tease any real numbers out of it for questions like, if you're Chinese at this period, what are your chances of ever getting executed for a crime? And there were a number of figures which suggest in the middle of the 19th century, you have a population of about 400 million. There is a source, whether reliable, we don't know, some American observer who thought that there were about 25,000 banished prisoners in China at one time. So that would suggest one Chinese out of 16,000 at that time was in that position. And there's also a suggestion of that executions in someone, and again, these are all different sources giving different estimates, so none of it's very reliable, that about 10% of the people condemned to things after the assizes were executed instead of being sent into the banishment. So that would then give you executions of 1 in 320,000. Not per year, of course, so... No, it isn't. I'm wrong, because the banished prisoners was a total number out there, and so I guess it was some kind of a cumulative figure. We don't know how many were executed before, but for a comparison for the U.S. execution rate, the peak execution rate in the U.S. during the 1930s was about 200 people per year, so roughly 1 per million. So that's even less than that very guesstimate figure, and the current figure is about 1 per 4 million, about 70,000. On the other hand, U.S. prisoners, I think if you look at the figure at the moment is what, about 1 million people in any given time are in jail, prison, some kind of confinement, and that's going to be a whole lot larger than at least the banished figures, I don't know at all. The Chinese aren't really using imprisonment very much as a punishment. They're mostly, which I think is true of the English too in the 18th century. I think part of the reason is the expensive punishment. Unless you've got some kind of work your prisoners can do, they're just eating out food and using guards and so forth. And so you either execute them, flog them, or find some way of putting them to work is a common pattern. So, all right. Well, I think we're done with time. Could people check my list? I'm noticing various people in this room who aren't names on my chart. So if you could take a look at my seating chart and make sure you're there in the right place.